get to talk about cosmology. And this method is based on the fact that space-time fluctuations could probably reflect themselves in a form of uncertainties in this geometry of space-time. So in other words, the structure of space-time probably can be inferred from the accuracy with which we can map that geometry. So I will start with discussion of mapping the geometry of space-time, and will show you that, in fact, this discussion will lead to a particular model of space-time form, now known as the holographic space-time form, and I will mention why it is called holographic in a moment. Although I have to admit that all my arguments are heuristic. I do not have any work really start with first principles, but I'm going to mention about one work which starts with the first principles and seems to agree with my conclusions. And then I would say a few words about cumulative effects. All those space-time formed effects are very, very small. So the trick is to accumulate enough those fluctuations to, so that those effects can be noticeable. But one has to be very careful how to accumulate, how to put together those fluctuations. Just like in random walk, you do not, in fact, just multiply individual walk by the number of intervals, by the number of walks. You have to take, in fact, the square root of the number of intervals. And for the holographic model, it turns out that that cumulative factor is given by not the square root, but the cube root of the number of intervals. And then I will go to phenomenology, and I'm going to show you that, well, in fact, now gamma ray bursts have been in the news, and but since due to lack of time, I would not talk about this topic and, until after my talk, if someone's interested. And I will concentrate on one way to detect space-time form. It is to make use of the very large telescope interferometers in operation in Chile. Excuse me. And if we are lucky, when the interferometers come to reach their design performance in a few years, there's a fighting chance that, in fact, those interferometers can be used to detect the quantum form that I will be talking about. But to do that, we have to be real lucky, just on the borderline of kind of things. And then I will go on to apply space-time form to do cosmology. And well, you can ask why? Why can I do that? Well, I do not know why. But it turns out that, in fact, right away, I will show you that, in fact, from this approach, one can show that dark energy and dark matter has to exist, independent of recent cosmological observations. I thought it's kind of cute. It's an independent way of showing that, in fact, we do have some kind of exotic matter in the universe, in addition to the ordinary matter that we see around us. And then it turns out that, this kind of dark energy that we're talking about, according to the model, in fact, can be thought of as composed of the constituents which obey not the conventional bosonic or fermionic statistics, but a statistics known as infinite statistics, about which, in fact, I know very little, so I would just mention those things. But it's kind of interesting that, in fact, there is another kind of statistics which is allowed by the field theory. It's known as infinite statistics. It is also known as quantum Boltzmann statistics. And I will talk about that a little bit. And it is interesting to know that, in fact, this group of people also has come to the conclusion that dark matter also obeyed this kind of statistics. And then I will summarize and my talk. So let me start with mapping of space-time. So let's consider a region of space of size, say, L. And I'm interested in the time interval, L over C, which is the amount of time that it takes light to cross the volume. So I want to map this space-time region. So this, so how do I do that? In fact, one way to do that is to fill space with a collection of clocks. And let's say that the clocks all together have mass m, So this is the trajectory of one clock, and those clocks exchange signals, and they click to mark the time. So the question is, how accurate can I make use of this collection clocks to map the geometry of this region of space-time. To do that, I'm going to suggest that one can regard this process of mapping geometry of space-time as some kind of computation. So clicks of clocks, sending of light signals, detection light signals, those are all in the process of computation. Let me take the word computation liberally. So let's regard the whole thing as a computer. The one advantage of doing this is that I can right away apply the so-called Magruss-Levitin theorem to put a bound on the number of operations, number of computations that can occur in that region of space-time. This theorem says that the rate of computation for any computer, in fact, is limited by the amount of energy that's available to do the computation. And here, the energy comes from the mass of the clock. So that the rate of operation is governed by the energy E, and E is now given by this mass of the clock. So the rate is given by E of H bar, and the amount of time is L. Well, from now on, let me use the unit such that C and H bar being 1. So times T, and T is L over C, as I said. So but now, you see that, of course, the number of operations would go linearly as the mass of the clocks. You say, wow, that's good. If I put more clocks into the region, I can have more operations. But that's not right. The thing is that if you put too much mass into that region, the whole thing, of course, it would collapse into a black hole. And we don't want to do that. Otherwise, we wouldn't observe it. We can see nothing. So that the mass is bounded by the size of the region. And now if I plug this M into this expression, I will come to the conclusion that the number of operations that can occur in this space-time region, in fact, is bounded by this, namely the size of that region, L squared, in the Planck unit. LP stands for Planck length. Now, let me regard that those events, those operations, as partitioning the space-time region into cells, into space-time cells. Then what I'm saying is that the number of space-time cells in that region, in fact, is bounded by L squared over Planck length squared. Here, already, you can see that this is related to holographic, holographic principle. It is related, since it goes as the square of the size, and not the cube of the size, like the volume. Okay, now let me ask the question. If I'm interested in to maximize the spatial resolution, what should I do? Of course, to do that, I have to sacrifice temporal resolution. And what do I mean by sacrificing temporal resolution? Yes.
At the moment, or they are independent? Before the mention of space time.
I come to that. Yes. This is why I have to say that. Let me now ask the question. I want maximum spatial resolution. To do that, I have to sacrifice temporal resolution. What do you mean by sacrificing temporal resolution? That means that I have to demand that all those clocks take no more than once. If it takes more than once, then of course that means that it can't resolve the time interval more. But I'm sacrificing now the temporal resolution. So let me in fact say that all the clocks take only once in that time interval. In that case, that means that they're all together, so many those cells, and each cell, so many cells. So each cell will occupy a certain spatial volume given by the volume of the region divided by the number of those cells. Okay? And then it will come to be given by, this is the volume. It's the size of the region times the square of the Planck length. Okay, that means that the average spatial separation of the cells will be given by the cube root of that volume. Which means that that would go as the cube root of the size times the 2^3 power of the Planck length. Now, because of the Planck length being so small, so for all practical purposes, this separation is extremely small. Even if Planck in L being the size of the observable universe, this separation is extremely small. I think something like 10 to the minus like a sizable proton, even if you factor the L spin size of the observable universe. So it's extremely small. However, it is already much bigger than the Planck length. And in fact, it is this fact that it's much bigger than Planck length, which makes the detection, hopefully, possible in my approach. Okay, now you can see why this is called the holographic model. Because, I guess I said, they are now all together, so many cells, and each cell occupies this much volume, and the total volume is L cubed, so that the total number of those cells will be this divided by that, that will give you back in this expression, which goes as L squared. So we can interpret that as the maximum number of those cells. And it goes like the area of the regional space. So you can interpret it as the amount of information that can be put into that region, or the number of bits that can be put into that region. Okay? And now also, we can interpret this this minimum separation cells, which goes like as the cube of L, as I said, to be the fluctuation of that distance, that's length L. So that if you want to measure a distance, say L, you can never do it accurately. The best accuracy that you can attain would be given by this length. The cube root of L times the cube root power of the Planck length. Before I proceed, let me in fact mention two things that we are talking about the maximum spatial resolution. So that means that in fact we have to require that there is the maximum possible energy density in the region. So that it is just on the verge of collapsing into the black hole, but not quite. So that the energy density goes as this, goes as the square root of 1 over L times the Planck length. And we'll come back to this later when we discuss cosmology. And also, for this case, also, we see that the number of bits goes like as L squared in Planck unit. Let me at this point mention, one paper, recent paper, by Gambini and Pulin. It's called Holography in Spherically Symmetric Loop Quantum Gravity. And as I said, I'm not an expert. I know very little about loop quantum gravity. So all I can do is, in fact, to tell you what he said. What he said is that, holography does indeed follow from the framework of loop quantum gravity in spherical symmetry, and that the result is robust. And they go on to say that holography follows from the dependence of the volume operator in spherical loop quantum gravity on the radial distance, yielding an uncertainty in the determination of volumes that grows radially. In our notation, it goes, the volume grows as L. And so this work seems to be in agreement with what we have just said. Namely, that the uncertainty in the measurement of a length L goes like the cube root of L. And I hope that they are right. That means that for the first time, in fact, people have been able to derive the result from first principles, whereas all my approaches are kind of heuristic, I admit. It's not rigorous. It is gratifying that even now there seems to be a group of people who seem to agree with what I've said.
How they derive it, you said no. And just to give us a clue.
Look at the graph. Let me not try to make a fool of myself.
Okay.
So just
to comment on this, this result is very, very restrictive. It is due to
spherical symmetry. Yes,
not just spherical symmetry, but a particular gauge fixing. And so it actually does not hold in general.
Oh, I see.
Yes.
Okay.
So you may not have holographic...
not at least from this kind of an approach.
Thank you. So I've been advocating that holographic conical model. Okay. That's the that L, because it's the cubic L. But for my later discussion, it is of interest, in fact, to consider the following. Namely, that instead of minimizing spatial resolution, that's what we have been doing. Okay. Let me now, in fact, consider the following. Okay. Namely, let's now spread the space-time shift that I talked about uniformly in both spatial directions as well as temporal resolutions. Remember, for my case, I sacrificed temporal resolution in favor of spatial resolution. But now, let's say that, in fact, I want to pursue a certain model for which, in fact, this is true. Namely, the spatial resolution is the same as the temporal resolution. Well, in that case, that's easy. Then the average spatial separation of cells will go like this. Namely, that this is the volume of the space-time divided by the number of the cells. Okay, so this is the average space-time volume occupied by which cell. If I now take the quarter power, then that will give you the spatial resolution for each direction of space. And similarly, the time separation also will be given by this. Same thing. So that, as I said, both spatial resolution and temporal resolution be comparable. In that case, then you come to the conclusion that this delta L, the uncertainty, or the fraction of the distance L, goes like this, the square root of L. And since the dependence, like this, on square root of L, is the hallmark of a random walk, so I call this the random walk model. It was advocated by my friend Emilio Camilla, who will be here, I think, shortly. And let me remind you that, in fact, for this model, they make the two kinds of resolutions, spatial resolutions and temporal resolutions, are the same. So the time between the ticks across will be equal to the time to communicate with unlabeled cells. So remember this. When I come to talk about cosmology, I will make use of this. And also, one can check right away that, in fact, this model uses a smaller bound on information context instead of going like L squared, in fact, goes like L squared to about 3/4. And also, because of the fact that this model says that the temporal resolution is the same as spatial resolution. In fact, in general, this model does not require the maximum energy density. The reason being that, in fact, the clock does not have to take every time after this amount of time. It can take fewer number of times. If those clocks take fewer number of times, you can still preserve the spatial resolution being given by the square root of L. If those clocks take less often, then of course they will take less energy. So that in general, this model does not require the maximum energy, in contrast to the holographic film model that I talked about. And we should also keep that in mind for later use. So that in picture, these are the two models. One can talk about more models. It turns out that these are the two models that would be most useful for my purpose. For the holographic model, those clocks, or those cells, are separated from each other by this short separation, which goes like the Q root of L. And that each clock takes only once, each one of them. In contrast, the random walk model is such that, in fact, the separation of the cells of the clocks are larger than what you find in our holographic model. Goes like square root of L, and that in fact there are more ticking of clocks, so that on average the interval between the successive ticks of clocks being given by the same as separation of the cells. One word about the cumulative effect of space-time fluctuations, which I already told you, but let me go over it very, very quickly, because it turns out that this is very important. So some people tend to forget about this, and they got the wrong result. And then they said, well, your model, in fact, has been eliminated. But the reason being that, in fact, they're mistaken. And they're mistaken because they forgot to take proper account of this factor, the so-called cumulative factor. Let's say that I have a certain distance, L. let me imagine that I partition that region, distance into many, many small intervals. Each one has the interval measured lambda. Okay. Then the question is, I have for each interval, there is a certain amount of fluctuations, which I will call delta lambda. And for the whole length L, there will be an uncertainty of fluctuation delta L. The question is, how is delta L related to delta lambda? Okay, very naively, we will say, since they are all together, L divided by lambda, that many of intervals. So obviously, this cumulative factor C would be just the number of intervals. That, of course, would be wrong, because all those fluctuations in the individual intervals are not coherent. Okay. In fact, since we know by applying the formula that the fluctuation goes like the cube root of the length, so the delta L goes like the cube root of L, delta lambda goes like the cube root of lambda, then you can deduce by the way, in fact, this cumulative factor C, in fact, goes like as the number of intervals, L over lambda, the cube root, not just the interval itself. Similarly, of course, for the random walk model, the cumulative factor will go like the square root. That's well known. Now let me come to the experimental detection of this kind of space-time fold. It was first pointed out by Liu and Human. Then in fact, one way to do that is the idea is the following, namely that if you have a source of radiation far, far away, let's say a distant equator, or a distant active galactic nucleus from the Earth, from the telescope, and if we observe the light coming from the source, the light would have gone over a huge distance. So that in fact, even though for each wavelength distance lambda of the light wave, the fluctuations is extremely small. But since the light wave has to go over such a huge distance, so if you add up all those fluctuations, maybe that's a way to have the effect observable. And as I said, they in fact had a very good idea, except that they got it wrong because of the fact that they forgot to take into account that Q root in the cumulative factor. In fact, they concluded that in fact all the space-time fold models in fact were ruled out. And that was big news a few years ago. They even made London Times, as I recall. But if you do things properly, then you find out that in fact for this radiation for the photons coming from this distant source, in fact, the phase cumulate to be given by this. So the cumulative phase fluctuation, capital delta phi, is goes like in fact goes like as the cube root of the distance that the light has to travel. Of course, this is to be expected, since the distance that the light has to travel is nothing but L. So corresponding to that L, that's the fluctuation, which is that L. So they in fact, the fluctuation in the phase is nothing aside from the factor of 2 pi. It's nothing but the fluctuation in the distance that the light has to travel, divided by the wavelength lambda itself. And now, if you take a look at some of the archived data, distant equators, stored in the Hubble Space Telescope. For example, if you take this particular HAN, PKS 1413, and this HAN is something like 1 megaparsec from us. And we detect the light in the infrared region, so that we know that the wavelength lambda. Then you can, of course, plug in this expression for the cumulative fluctuations in the phase, and it comes out to be extremely small. Is 10 to the minus 9 times 2 pi. But if you forget about this Q root factor, this number would get to be quite large. In fact, would be of the order of 2 pi or larger. So that in fact, when we say that the fluctuation is such that in fact, it's so huge that in fact, one should see no interference pattern, there would be a blur. But that's not true. In fact, the Hubble Space Telescope data indicates that in fact, this object, in fact, is not blurred at all. And the way to resolve the paradox is that, in fact, one has to take into account the proper account of the cumulative factor for which there's a qubit power. Okay, so that for our perfect form model, for this object, the delta phi is given by this. So please remember this. So it goes like 10 to the minus 9, 2 pi. So we need to have an improvement of 9 orders of magnitude in order to see the quantum form effect. This is almost hopeless. On the other hand, now if you apply the same expression for this fluctuational phase, for the random walk model, for the random walk model, this power instead of q root, instead of 1/3, is 1/2. Then it turns out this ratio L over lambda is extremely large, such that a small change in the power makes a lot of difference. For the random walk model, for which the power is 1/2, so square root, then it turns out that in fact, the fluctuation phase is comparable to 2 pi. So that means that in fact the random walk model seems to be marginally ruled out. But I'm really not interested in the random walk model. I'm more interested in the holographic form model. And now I have to overcome 9 orders of magnitude in order to see the effect. How do I do that? I was discussing this with one of my colleagues in astronomy by the name of Christensen. He said, in fact, no worry. That's a better way of doing things. Your radiation suffers not only a fluctuation in phase, but its wave vector k also undergoes a fluctuation. So the direction of your wave vector, in fact, fluctuates a little bit. And you do things properly. So here I have a cartoon of what we propose to do. Namely, let's say that we have two telescopes separated by a baseline length d. So together, these two telescopes can form an interferometer. And I've drawn here a wavefront of the light coming from a distant quasar. And k is nothing but the wave vector. And the wiggle line here stands for the fact that, in fact, there's fluctuation in phase. And because of that, in fact, there is also a fluctuation in the direction of k. It turns out that the fluctuation is given by the fluctuation in the phase delta phi divided by 2 pi. And if you analyze this a little bit deeper, then you come to the conclusion that, in fact, space-time form through which the light has to travel from distant quasar to our telescope, to our interferometer, in fact, creates a so-called thin disk, whose angle diameter is nothing but the fluctuation in the direction of this wave vector, delta phi divided by 2 pi. So that for telescope, for interferometer with baseline length d, that means that, in fact, the whole effect will show up in the interferometer fringe pattern as the decreasing of the fringe visibility. Once that fluctuation in the phase reaches this value of lambda over d. Lambda is the wavelength of light, which is of something like a micron. D, of course, is microscopic distance, say meters, hundreds of meters. So that in principle, this fraction can be extremely small. Now remember, I talk about the phase fluctuations. And in order to use such a phase fluctuations to detect space-time form, we need delta phi to be comparable to 2 pi. But now my astronomer colleague tells me that in fact, by making use of the fact that the wave vector of the radiation field, in fact, also undergoes quantum fluctuations. One only to detect the quantum form, one only needs the fluctuations of the phase to be given by this, which in principle can be much, much smaller than one. So here is the trick, so that we can enhance the effect. Yes.
Because there must be some limit or some range of validity of this form, because I could, in principle, make d much smaller than the wavelength of lambda, so the delta phi would be larger than 2 pi. So
no, in fact, when if things go bigger than 2 pi, I would not believe those things. So then, in fact, all I've been doing is that I've taken into account the linear effect. So that could be quadratic and higher order effects. Yes. Right, exactly. Yes, thank you. Okay, we talk about the particular AGN. PK8S1413. Let's use it again. Okay. For that, okay, we know baseline length is something of order of meter. And we also know, as I told you, that we know the wavelength. It is 2 microns or so. Then you can plug in the value for the lambda over d, so that we see that once, for this object, then we will expect, according to what we have been talking about, we will be able to detect baseline form once, this identifier reaches this value, which of course is much, as I said, much more than one. Well, so now you see that this is 10 to the minus 6 times 2 pi. So we have gained 6 orders of magnitude. That's not bad at all. And if we apply that to the holographic, to the random walk model, of course, this is much, much less than what is predicted by the random walk model. So that now, instead of marginally root out, I think, that model, I think, is convincingly ruled out by 6 orders of magnitude. However, as you may recall, that in fact, to test our holographic form model, we need an extremely small delta phi, something like 10 to the minus 9 times 2 pi. Well, we can now achieve 10 to the minus 6 times 2 pi. So we still have 3 orders of magnitude to go. So close but no cigar, as they said. Now the exciting news. Which is no longer news anymore because I have talked about this for a couple of years already. But for this conference, let's say that it's still exciting news. Namely that, in fact, in a few years, when the very large telescopes, interferometers, reach their design performance, I was told that you better dig into that in about 3 or 4 years. There's a chance that, in fact, they can go down to verify comparable, in fact, close to 10 times 10 to the minus 9 radians, which of course is extremely close to what I need, which is 10 to the minus 9 times 2 pi. It's marginally. I will hope that they could improve the sensitivity and resolution at least one order of magnitude better, but they said unlikely. And then I said, well, what about the next generation of telescopes? This one is the very large telescope. The next one you can guess is by the name of extremely large telescopes. And it turns out that in fact that will be of no help according to the design. So if you miss this chance with VLT, I'm afraid I will retire a very disappointed man in 10 years or so. Oh, I should have also mentioned that in fact there's one main good thing about this method. Namely, that in fact, we do not need extra telescope time to do that. All we need would be archived data, so that all the data being stored, we can eventually ask the VLT people for the data, and then we can analyze the data. And of course, that would be a question of sensitivity, etc. But let's assume that in fact, those things can be overcome, those problems can be overcome. As I said, there's not only a chance that particular effect can be detected, and I would not, if I were you, I would not bet too much money on it. Let me skip gamma ray burst for the time being, and if there are interest in this topic from a perspective, I'll be very happy to talk about it. Now, let me go on to talk about cosmology. Let's say that we want to apply the holographic quantum form model to cosmology. Well, that's interesting. The thing is that we know the size of the universe. We know how long the universe has existed. We know the energy density of the universe. From all this, we right away can get, oh, by the way, I'm sorry. I hope by now you do not mind me for assuming that, in fact, I can regard the whole universe as a computer. A lot of people don't like that, but please allow me to do it so that I can proceed. And in fact, there's no reason why not. So let's say that. I say that the universe, the whole thing, is a big computer. and I know something about its density, about how long it's been computing, and the size of the computer. And from those, I can calculate right away by appealing to the Michaelis-Levitin theorem. The rate of computation of the whole universe, it comes out to be 10 to the 106 per second. I know how long it's been computing, roughly. So that I know that the number of operations, that the number of computations that whole universe has accomplished is something like 10 to the 123. Okay? Now at this point.
Your assumptions under that. You assume that it's four.
I know the rate.
But it's four dimensional. You assume that it's four dimensional.
I know the rate.
Okay. Yeah,
and I know the amount of time. So then I know the number of operations. Automated wise. Okay. Alright. So it's nothing but this times the number of years that the universe has come into existence.
Yes,
I said, all the middle class.
You assume a four-dimensional universe, and you assume the age of the universe as we know today.
Yes.
I don't understand.
Okay. So that's good. Now, at this point, let me assume that all the information in this big computer is stored in conventional method, ordinary method that we are all familiar with. In that case, then we can make use of our knowledge of statistical mechanics. Okay, let's, in fact, for simplicity, let's say that all the matter is, in fact, in the universe, ordinary matter being massless, because of the fact that, in fact, matter can store the maximum number of information if the matter is relativistic. So let me assume that the matter is massless. So that we know the temperature, so that we know the density, energy density, it goes like the fourth power of the temperature, and we know the entropy density, and goes like, which goes like as the cube root of the temperature. From this, you can deduce that the number of bits in this big computer, if all the information is stored in the regular conventional matter, will go like the number of operations to the 3/4 power. And it comes out to be 10 to the 92. Yeah. So that's the number of bits of information in this big computer, the whole universe. Now, I know the size of the universe, I know the number of bits, then I can find out the distance between the neighboring bits, and we do the calculation, it comes out to be 10 to the minus 3 centimeters. And it takes light about 10 to the minus 14 seconds to go from one bit to another bit. On the other hand, I note the number of bits, and I also note the computation rate. From this, I can find out how long does it take one bit to flip once. And it comes out to be 10 to the minus 14 seconds. So you notice that this number is the same as this number. So that means that, in fact, I come to the conclusion that if we agree that, if we suppose that, in fact, all the information in the whole universe is stored in conventional matter, then this will correspond to a distribution event in which each bit flips in the same amount of time that it takes light to communicate between the bits. And now, I remind you about the random walk model. And for the random walk model, you remember that the time that each clock takes the same amount of time that it takes to communicate between the clocks. Now replace the ticking of clocks by the flipping of bits. Then you will get what we have here. As I said, this is a heuristic argument, but I think I do not see what's wrong with that. So that we come to the conclusion that the accuracy to which ordinary matter maps out the space-time geometry of the universe corresponds to the case of events spread out uniformly in space-time, i.e. corresponds to the random walk model. So somehow, conventional matter is somehow related to the random walk model in a very funny way. But we already said that the random walk model seems to be ruled out by six orders of magnitude, rather convincingly. So if it's ruled out, that means that space-time can be mapped to a fine accuracy. Then that can be proved by using ordinary matter. if ordinary matter cannot be used to provide that kind of accuracy with which the universe can map up its own geometry, then what can it do? Well, that means that it has to make use of other kind of matter. What other kind of matter? The only thing that I can think of would be dark energy. Yes.
The energy in general, not matter.
I do not know if it's something. Most likely energy. Yeah.
But here, when you say ordinary matter, does it include gas or is it just massless scalar?
You could not ordinary think fermions and bosons, all those things that we're familiar with. How come to those? Okay. With exotic. That's the one that I said, in fact, okay, obey even different statistics.
But you're assuming only one form of
pressure,
isn't it?
Like, the very fact I make use of the density, energy difficulties like the power temperature, as I said, the matter can store the maximum amount of information if the matter is registered. So I'm being generous already. And even if after the technology, it still doesn't work. Yes.
So you're taking for granted that all the information has to be stored in the matter degrees of freedom. The geometry or gravitational degrees of freedom cannot store information about their own. Something like that.
You talk about the gravitational entropy. It's interesting that, in fact, you're right. I've not been completely honest. I just used ordinary matter. But of course, we know that there is the entropy stored in black holes, the center of all the galaxies. In fact, the amount of entropy would be like at least 10 orders of magnitude bigger than what I quoted for ordinary matter. But even if you take account all those gravitational entropies stored in black holes, etc., still, they were far below the number that we need 10 to the power 120.
There's something I'm not understanding about this.
Yeah,
10 to the minus 3 centimeters is a huge distance. 10 to the minus 14 seconds is a long time compared to strong electromagnetic decays. So why does normal particle physics work so well without assuming any fluctuations in space-time fault? I mean, you can use standard
space quantum. The reason being that, that's why the energy is stuck. Very enough.
Pardon me?
That's why the kind of matter that we need would be extremely inert.
No, but
so that's why it's dark
energy. Does it mean ordinary matter doesn't feel these kinds of space-time fluctuations? Because if it experiences them, why doesn't it significantly modify standard interactions in particle physics? That's what I'm confused about.
Well,
are you saying that ordinary matter is insensitive to this, this unusual matter feels this? I'm not understanding the picture.
This is the average value, of course. Okay. And what means you can bigger and smaller compared to that value.
Yeah,
of course, a lot of space is empty.
But strong interactions, we know 10 to the minus 24 seconds.
I think the point is that within, the holographic principle tells you that you have a limited number of degrees of freedom to work with.
Mm-hmm.
But, locally, as he says, it is empty in the rest of the universe. You have a lot of degrees of freedom to do your local particle physics experiment in a certain little region. And there you can reach, a lot higher accuracy in time and space and so on. But if you were to do particle physics at that accuracy, over all of the universe, then it wouldn't work.
But I don't see why it needs to be over the full universe. We already had a model in which you had phase fronts fluctuating over these distance scales. So why doesn't everything else fluctuate over these distance scales?
And then there's also the other fact that this is where he doesn't have dark matter. So if you have dark matter, you have more precise things.
But why isn't ordinary matter subject to these fluctuations the same? I don't see why it matters if you have dark matter or not.
If you have dark matter, then the precision scale of everything is small.
We can talk about that.
So you need enough dark matter to push the precision scale down 10, 15 orders of magnitude. That's what you've got to do.
Can I postpone that discussion later? All right. So that now, if you mean by what I've just told you, so that in fact from this approach to cosmology, it seems like dark energy or dark matter is still necessary. Okay, let me remind you, okay, so there are two features to this cosmology, which I call the holographic form cosmology, namely that it has critical cosmic energy, and that is because of the fact that, remember, I told you when I introduced the holographic form model that this is critical, meaning the energy density is critical, just enough to avoid the whole thing to collapse in the black hole. And now, it is this energy is nothing but the energy density that we observe in the universe. Because like as in fact the Hubble parameter square in Planck. Also, another feature of this cosmology is that in fact the universe contains a lot of information that we have not seen. It is just like in fact the square of the Hubble length. Now, okay, of course, we know the energy density of the whole universe, and we know the amount of the number of bits in this whole big computer universe, then we can figure out what's the average energy killed by each bit. If you do the calculation, it's extremely small. It goes as the inverse of the Hubble length. So all of those bits, and if I can call them quote unquote particles, all those particles have extremely low energy. And if you have such long wavelength particles, that means that their kinetic energy got to be negligible. So at first sight, it seems that if the kinetic energy is small, that means the pressure will be of order minus the energy density. In that case, then we will seem to have gas nearer, like quintessence. So that comes for the acceleration of the universe, accelerating the expansion of the universe. But in fact, that's not true. In fact, if you in fact, forget about matter at this point, just concentrate on dark energy, and for which the energy density goes like Hubble square. Okay, and then you plug this in for the energy density into the Freeman equation, then you find out that in fact the Hubble parameter goes like 1 over a, the cosmic vector, and cosmic vector goes like time. But you also find out that in fact the pressure, it does not go like minus rho, but minus one third of rho. When I found this, I was very disappointed. I said, so this corresponds to, of course, the deceleration parameter being zero. So the expansion is neither accelerating nor decelerating. But we know the universe has undergone both phases, accelerating expansion as well as decelerating expansion. So how am I going to account for that? But then on first thought, in fact, I like the result that in fact, P just is of the value just at that point, but that's neither acceleration nor deceleration. Since if we want the model to be able to do cosmology for the throughout the cosmic history, that means that we have to be able to explain for this model both accelerating expansion as well as deceleration expansion. So the best position for us to be in will be in fact at this particular point. It's neither accelerating nor deceleration. They said, what's the use? It turns out that Simdal and collaborators have been working on problems of this sort. And they said that if in fact one includes interactions between dark energy and dark matter and ordinary matter, then in fact one can have an effective equation state such that in fact in the appropriate epoch of the universe, one could have negative pressure, enough negative pressure to accelerate the expansion. And we could also, hopefully, also have a positive pressure to account for the decelerating expansion phase of the universe. And I do not know that yet. And this is a hope.
There is supposed to be made of ordinary energy.
That I do not know, really. That I have not. But
then we're back to the previous question.
That I do not know. That I do not know. That I do not know. I'm in the process of learning enough cosmology. Okay. Yes, I agree completely.
Which gives most of the
in fact, it's already very delicate. In fact, for this model, PC reminds a third of row, which corresponds to XL, deserving the parameter between XL and 0. It's neither accelerated nor deserved. So it depends on the, I think, the interaction. But we have to take into account the effect of matter in the interactions with this kind of exotic matter. Now, okay, let's assume that, in fact, at the point, dark energy is composed of those long-wave, quote-unquote, particles. And the question is, how different are those particles from ordinary particles that we are familiar with? Now, okay, to do that, let me, in fact, okay, say that we have n such particles, okay, a huge number, because like in fact, square of the Hubble length, and each particle, okay, and let's say that okay, we are talking about okay, n such particles, in okay, the volume given by the cube of Hubble length, so that is the whole universe, and that, okay, that okay, those particles are in equilibrium at temperature inverse of the Hubble length. And let's assume for the time that in fact those particles, that gas, in fact obey the ordinary Boltzmann statistics. In that case, I can do the calculation right away. The partition function goes like this. Okay, and there's so many of those particles. Okay, power of this, the volume, which is the whole universe, divided by the cube of the thermal wavelength, okay, which goes like inverse of temperature. Okay, and I can plug this in, and then I calculate the entropy of the system, which goes like this. Okay, it goes like this, n times log of this. Forget about this term, which is of order 1 inside the bracket. Now, in this log, you notice there is V over lambda cube, which, of course, since lambda is of order inverse of temperature, and temperature is inverse of the Hubble length, and the volume is Q of Hubble length, so that in fact, V over lambda cube is of order 1. So that, okay, is a log, you have something like log of 1 over n. And n is a huge number. Log 1 over n is extremely negative. If, okay, dominate over this constant term. So they will come to the conclusion that the entropy, okay, if I type this kind of statistics, is negative, which is nonsense. Then you said, well, one thing that the problem is that, okay, we said that in fact, okay, n is small of order 1, this should be no problem. But n cannot be 1. I already said that in fact, okay, n is huge. 10 to the 123, how can it be 1? Well, then how can we solve the problem? Okay, the problem, of course, solved if, okay, I already told you the answer, meaning that I can avoid this paradox if this factor n is not there inside the law. Let's assume this is the case for time being. In other words, if in fact this okay, 1 over n factorial factor is not there in the partition function, then there should be no problem. Then you can do the calculation and you will get this to the entropy. So that when V over lambda cube is over the 1, so this both terms inside the bracket is over the 1, so that in fact S entropy is of order of n, the number of particles. So everything is 1. It's obviously positive. And it's of order of n, that's what we expect, what we hope. But how can that be? That can be, as I said, if this factor is not there. This, of course, is nothing but the Gibbs factor in Boltzmann statistics. So if that, okay, that was not there, that means that, in fact, those particles we assume to be identical. In fact, are not identical. They are not identical, and they are distinguishable. If they are distinguishable, that means that that factor of okay, n factorial, 1 of n factorial, is not there. Then I will get sensible results. So the conclusion of this heuristic argument is that okay, if I assume dark matter to be composed of those okay, peculiar constituents, then those constituents okay, go to obey statistics such that that factor is not there. Now the only non-consistent statistics I was told in greater than two space dimensions, without this Gibbs structure, is the quantum Boltzmann statistics, also known as infinite statistics. And it's
actually, Benatti and Florianini have claimed long ago that D particles, zero, would have infinite statistics.
I can't, thank you. No, I'm not familiar with this. particular part, maybe you can tell me later.
I mean, I know.
Yeah.
Primarily terminology.
That's interesting, because I...
I don't expect we might have a problem with the MEV.
Okay, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, yeah. So that's, okay, I'm forced into a sort of speculation. But we cut the speculation as, okay, although outrageous, okay, is in fact logical. So I call this a logical speculation. That those the particles constituted into dark matter obey infinite statistics rather than a familiar Fermi or Boole statistics. And this is the overriding difference between the dark energy and ordinary matter. Because they even obey the different statistics. Now, okay, I'm coming to this. Okay, so I'm familiar. Okay. Few months ago, in July, I noticed that this paper, okay, written by my friend Minnick and his collaborators, and using the M theory, the D-knot brain, etc., and they come. Okay. I do not know whether they really referred to the paper. Eh?
Well, we are using, but I guess.
Yeah, well, I couldn't do that. I just want to mention that.
Sure.
Okay. And since I'm not an expert, in fact, I know very little about M theory. But, okay.
That.
That makes me feel a little better. Okay. They come to the conclusion that dark energy is associated with the quantum of infinite statistics. And they came up, then they went on to say that, in fact, speculated that they started from another approach. I also came to a certain conclusion. So now, in fact, so they should have referred
to it. And I think Florianini used it long ago to associate
with... When was that?
91, around 2000, yeah.
Okay.
Is your hologram involved taking into account the distinguishability now of the individual flux you're using to begin with, in that you can't really just apply them to being all equal when you sperm out?
No, I use ordinary matter to do the experiments. But the properties that I'm trying to investigate can't do with space-time itself. I just use the ordinary matter as tools. So there's no conflict between
the... With the ordinary matter, were we not using the dark energy / dark matter to infer that they as well?
Ordinary matter constitutes, okay, we're 5% or so, as we know, of the nuclear energy. So okay, as a rough approximation, okay, I've been ignoring those. As I said, one goes to do real cosmology, one is to take into account all these things, the interaction, etc. And at that time, well, I do not know whether, in fact, your question can be answered.
So does this mean, according to this, that dark energy has infinite... There are no distinguishable particles in dark energy. There are infinitely many, each of which are distinguishable one from the other.
Thank you.
Is that correct?
I'm coming. I know, as I said, I know very little about infinite physics, but okay, all I know is by reading two papers by Quimper in particular. Quimper and other people have been working on this. Okay, they said that one thought representation of infinite statistics is given by this kind of key definition of the competition relations. And notice that it is it's parameterized by the number q is between -1 and 1. Okay, when Q is equal to -1 or 1, of course you get back to ordinary statistics, ordinary, post and Fermi statistics. And so, but now, if Q is 0, then of course the computational relation just vastly change. And Asano, in fact, has been telling me about this, that they encounter this kind of thing also in non-commutative geometry. But instead of a fixed number q here, in fact, it depends upon energy momentum. But it's very curious that, in fact, all kind of unlovely approaches involving quantum gravity now it seems to converge to some kind of funny kind of statistics. Okay, and those people also claim that this in fact, can be in any representation of the permutation group. Unlike the Fermi and the Boole statistics, of course, both ones got to be in totally symmetric state, and the Fermi has got to be in a totally symmetric state. But in this kind of statistics, that's no longer so. So what can we get? One can look upon this kind of statistics as nothing but something corresponding to a statistics of identical particles with an infinite number of internal degrees of freedom. In fact, that's what meant Minnick, the guy who the paper that I just referred to. Okay. In that case, then that would correspond to, okay, that would be equivalent to a statistics of non-identical particles. Non-identical because they are particles that now can be distinguishable by their internal states.
There's an implied energy spectrum to that.
Yeah, of course.
But there must be constraints there, because then you have potentially infinitely many interactions, each with their own coupling. The resolution theory would lose predictive power without tight constraints being imposed on.
I have no good answer.
My main worry is it depends on their amount.
Yes. But predictive power will just go down the tubes unless you.
Well, that's another problem. 15 minutes about problems.
Okay, it's not a problem.
Thank you. Okay. I come to Greenberg. Okay. A theory of particles obeying infinite statistics, in fact, cannot be local. Thank you. In fact, one can check that, as Greenberg did. The number operators and the Hamiltonian, et cetera, in fact, are both non-local as well as non-polynomial. So that, okay, in the few operators. So the number operator, in fact, consists of an infinite series involving those, okay, creation and annihilation operators. So that, in fact, the theories of this kind, being non-local, makes it very difficult to construct consistent, okay, local relativistic point of view theory. So that seems to be a big defect. However, being an optimistic guy, I'd like to change to convert that disaster into a virtue. So, okay, well, non-locality. So we have encountered non-locality in infinite statistics. But this is not the first time that we have encountered non-locality. Okay, you remember that I've been talking about holographic principle. In fact, there is some sort of non-locality already in our holographic principle. Maybe, just maybe, these two kinds of non-localities, in fact, are related in certain way. I don't know. So, in fact, okay, since the holographic principle is such a crucial ingredient in the construction of quantum gravity, so maybe, in fact, okay, when one does quantum gravity, one indeed has to make use of this kind of statistics, or at least that kind of commutation relations for non-commutative geometry. So this is an indication that, in fact, things are not as simple as we think. So in fact, we do have to go beyond the ordinary Bose and Fermi statistics to do quantum gravity, in spite of the fact that there are a lot of problems. In fact, the first person who talk about infinite statistics in connection with gravity, in fact, was made by Strominger some years ago. He showed that charged extremal black holes all have to obey infinite statistics. And now, from M-theory and in my own work, I have shown that, in fact, indeed, we encounter this kind of statistics. So that one conjecture is such that this kind of discussion seems to lead us to believe that the non-perturbative dynamics of gravity is unitary, but not local. That has been pointed out by Giddens and other people. Let me now summarize, since I know that I'm running short of time. So I hope I've convinced you that space-time does undergo quantum fluctuations. And that the fluctuations scale as the qubit of the distance. And this is supported to some extent by Gambini and Poulin, maybe in certain only restricted, under certain restrictions. Still, I take it as a plus. Now, I've not been able, in fact, to answer too many questions because, in fact, I do not have at my disposal a quantum gravity theory. At least I do not know. So that I've been making use of only two ingredients, namely that quantum mechanics, the uncertainty, and gravity, namely that, in fact, if we put too much matter in the region, the whole thing will collapse in the black hole. I have to avoid that. Those are the only two ingredients I've used. And it's amazing that, in fact, I've been able to derive, something interesting. I hope you agree with that. Now the detection of those fluctuations is difficult, but perhaps not impossible. And with some luck, we will be able to see, to be able to detect those fluctuations with the very large telescope interferometers. And as I said, that is, we are lucky, if I am lucky. And also, I have discussed how to use space-time form, the kind of space-time form that I'm talking about, to do cosmology. And we were led to the conclusion that, in fact, in this scenario, dark energy, dark matter has to exist. Otherwise, otherwise, in fact, the fluctuations would be much bigger, would go like the square root instead of cube root. I also made the outrageous speculation that particles constituent dark matter, dark energy, obey infinite statistics. And as I wrote at the bottom of this transparency, the phenomenology of this cosmology has yet to be studied, and I haven't done so. Thank you. Sorry for all going over time.
Thanks for all these very nice talks. So this is an example for one of these interesting models where the particle physicist is not a question box properly. So we have already some questions. We have time for one, two more.
Yeah. I want to get back right to the beginning to this issue of phase fluctuations and photons coming from distant galaxies. And one calculation had been done where these fluctuations are built up coherently, but you were arguing that we should, quote, add phases randomly, unquote.
Right.
This suggests that you've got a model in mind where the photon is undergoing a large number of, shall we say, steps on its way from the galaxy to
right.
us. But it's a very odd scaling law because the number of steps the photon goes through between the galaxy and us goes as the number of wavelengths to the galaxy to the two-thirds power. And I'm not sure, are these steps then supposed to be involved with quantum collapse in the wave function or not?
In fact,
if they are, doesn't that screw up interferometry here?
You can take each size of each step to almost as much as you like. You got all the way to the tunneling. It still turns out, in fact, that will not affect anything. So I take it as a pretty robust result. And of course, as I said, for the random model, the cumulative factor goes like the square root, as we expect.
It goes
like
square root of the number of wavelengths.
That's right. Of the number of the distance divided by the
wavelength. Yeah,
well, the distance divided by the wavelength. The number of steps of the fluctuation.
But the distance cube thing that you were arguing is then some very peculiar sort of random.
That's yes.
The effective size of the random.
Yes, this is a very.
Both on the wavelength of the photon and the distance to the galaxy.
Yes, this is a very,
peculiar.
Yes, this is a very peculiar kind of power, and it in fact corresponds to what people in statistics call the Brownian motion with self-similarity parameter 1/3, which is not very familiar to most of us. I agree. It's very strange, but the consistency.
Does this actually force a collapse of the wave function? Should I think of the photon wave function being collapsed every time one of these steps?
No, it just undergoes fluctuations. And of course, it's not detected until it comes to your telescope. Okay.
It's a fact that the undergoing random interactions with
I know what you're trying to get.
Everything is going
to.
Okay.
If you have the whole thing collapsed, at this interval, then in fact, that would be the factor, the number, then you will multiply by the number of intervals. And that, of course, will give you an extremely large result, and that will rule out everything. I agree.
The phase changes its time, it interacts. Its phase will be fine.
Right, but I'm also worried that would then destroy things like interferometry experiments people do.
You mean as a measurement problem?
Yeah.
Now, that is right. That is a totally different age.
I do not understand that, but we can talk about it.
Yeah, that's. Okay, so I had a sort of different question about the beginning of the talk, but it's not too vague. So you started by just combining some general observations about the theories we already have, quantum mechanics and general relativity. But then by the time you come to discussing the phenomenology of these things, it seemed like all the ideas were Lorentz breaking. So does that...
Not Lorentz breaking, I did not say that. In fact, I still have Lorentz invariance, but I will think of one Lorentz... Okay, two things, and it goes under fluctuations. So in particular, if I say, look at just a moment, let me see. I have it somewhere. Well, okay, let's measure. Okay, if you look at the dispersion relation, E squared minus P squared C squared C squared M squared C4, okay, that's still there on the average. So it will be modified by assuming the term, very small term. But that term got on the average is zero. So yeah, it's an equal fluctuation.
Some kind of finding.
Yes, okay, so, like everything else, I mean, even dispersion relations, can go fluctuations. Yeah. Well, as much plus as minus.
But where that uncertainty, doesn't it vary coming to?
But you can measure that kind of fluctuations. I mean, with the root mean square, I mean, you can measure that. By means of. In fact, it's because of that we have to take in use, in fact, the correct cumulative effect. Because like the cumulative
effect. It seemed like there was some frame coming in. For instance, when you were talking about light propagating over long distances and losing coherence, and what frame are you measuring the distance in from this distant thing, if it's supposed to be a distant object? If it's just a, like what, it seems like there's some frame coming into that argument.
So of course radiation from distant sources never propagates through the vacuum, but through all kinds of plasmas.
Yes, so in fact, we will have to...
Can you ever manage to measure an effect? Can you ever detangle this?
Yeah, this one transfer has got to masking, it's a tip, etc. Okay, and of course, in fact, since I mentioned about using the very large telescope to form them, one also have to worry about the turbulence, atmospheric turbulence, etc. Those are big problems, but maybe we can. I don't know whether, in fact, the astronomers will be able to disentangle all those things, but I hope they do. I really don't know.
I think we'll finish here.